The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, and welcome to episode 16, Fixing Fight Club Just Say No to NATO, part 2 on the War Notes, a conflict podcast. This is Bill Buford, and welcome aboard once again. For those of you who are new listeners, thank you for tuning in and seeing what you think of this. A little bit of housekeeping. I would be most appreciative, whether a new listener or a perennial listener, if you would be so kind as to leave reviews or recommendations of this podcast. If you like it, recommend it to friends, family, and colleagues. I'd be obliged if you spread the word, and thank you for that. So nearly 2 months ago on January 20th, I published episode 9, Just Say No to NATO, in my Fixing Fight Club series that I did on this conflict podcast, War Notes. And I thought, well, I'm done with NATO. Well, I'm not. Hence the part 2 that you're seeing today. I have become increasingly frustrated with the last 60 days in watching what I have now deemed the European Union Soviet Socialist Republic, the EUSSR. I will be employing that term until constituent states break apart, countries, the 31, 32 countries in NATO and the EU, as we speak, secede and balkanize and get away from this demon in Brussels that has turned into a warmongering institution of the First Order with its military arm, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, of which America has the misfortune of remaining a signatory. I will send you back to episode 9 concerning NATO, where I went through some of the history of NATO since 1946, and then fast forwarding to 1991 and the expansion of the NATO blob from 11 constituent countries in Western Europe to the 31 and 32 that are presently here. And in my mind, the absolutely shocking prospect of taking Sweden and Finland, formerly neutral countries, not members of NATO. I'm going to use Finland as Exhibit A, why I think the prospect of their joining NATO is so foolhardy in so many ways, and just the insane saber-rattling and warmongering by a defense entity, in this case, NATO less the U.S., if the U.S. became sober and backed out of this warmongering entity, and how they are absolutely incapable of delivering on any of the threats that they're making to Russia and the BRICS countries. So if you'll take a listen to that podcast episode, it will be a good preamble to this particular episode, but I think this episode can stand alone 2 months after, in further signifying that American membership in NATO, if it was a bad idea 2 months ago, it's an even worse idea right now. As I elucidated in that previous episode, in 1991-92, when the Warsaw Pact dissolved, NATO should have dissolved, and America's entry into NATO should have dissolved. Let's recall that in the 20th century, two European wars originated in Europe. And let's also recall that in September 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland, the Russians met them in the middle, and Winston Churchill, while not PM, had the ear of the PM at the time, who declared war on Germany and not Russia that met them in the middle. Mind you, I think that Woodrow Wilson was patient zero for World War I for a variety of reasons, but I will sum it up in a very pithy little riddle, which is this. a time cop goes back in time and he reports back and he goes to his time cop captain and says, "You sent me back to kill baby Hitler, but I assassinated Woodrow Wilson instead." To which the time cop captain responds, "Adolf who?" So, and I have covered this in a variety of other episodes where we've talked about the various historian kerfuffles that are going on now with this mass misapprehension of the meaning of World War I and World War II. Two European wars that turned into world wars that were a result of squabbles between Europeans. Now we have the rather emasculated and terribly under-equipped, under-trained, and, well, for now, under-financed NATO forces, which have not substantially contributed to the vast majority of defense that is offered by the United States' participation in NATO, with all of the American bases within Europe proper, American forces there, and America pretty much being not only the senior partner, but the one who puts in the most funds, treasure, and manpower to put NATO together and make it a formidable military force. Although I would tell you that in the 21st century, America and its NATO allies are presently fighting with a 20th century force in the 21st century revolutions in military affairs that we are seeing before our very eyes. And that I will stipulate that the Russians are probably not only the most blooded, but the most capable conventional force on the face of the planet as we speak. Now, against the Russians, what we see with Ukraine is that after 3 years of struggle, the stalemate and defeat of Ukraine is rather inevitable to savvy and informed conflict observers, excepting those who happen to be on the continent of Europe, where they think that if we throw enough money at this, if we spend enough blood and treasure on this, and surprisingly enough, you have Reich Minister Starmer, who is of late the successful architect of Operation Sea Lion, which didn't succeed, which was the German invasion, the Nazi invasion of the UK in 1940-41. Didn't happen, but Starmer managed to pull it off. And now what you're seeing is a government supremacist enclave in the UK that is trying to take the United Kingdom, which is a third world country with one teetering first world city, London, into the brink, over the abyss, into war yet again, which will prove probably, in my mind, to be the tombstone for the late and great United Kingdom. Now, it isn't only that pesky little island. It is the leadership, as it were, and I say that in air quotes, of the European Union in Brussels that is pressing for war, 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 and more, more, more of the same instead of seeking peace in the Ukraine, which would be the logical, rational, and realpolitik answer to the problems that are presently there. So Ted Galen Carpenter, one of my favorites from the Cato Institute, and I consider the Cato Institute to be a bought and paid for advocacy tank for the District of Columbia, which is Mordor on the Potomac, but he's one of the few sober voices left there. For decades, in my mind, he has been one of not only the progenitors, but one of the wiser graybeards when talking about NATO, when talking about war, when talking about foreign policy. So despite this being from over a year ago, and I will post the article link in the show notes so that you can go there yourself, quote, U.S. leaders and their media allies have fostered numerous self-serving myths about the war in Ukraine. One myth is that Russia's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine was entirely unprovoked, since NATO's expansion to Russia's border was not a hostile act. Another fable is that Ukraine is a freedom-loving democracy. Still another is that the Russian-Ukraine war is not merely an ugly turf war between two corrupt, autocratic regimes, but it is instead part of an existential global struggle between democracy and authoritarianism. Failure to sustain democratic, in air quotes, Ukraine, the story goes, would jeopardize the entire rules-based international order. U.S. and NATO officials likely do not believe a word of these arguments, even as they avidly circulate such propaganda. However, they do seem to subscribe to another more dangerous myth, that the alliance can provide even greater amounts of financial aid and more powerful weaponry to the Ukraine without becoming an active belligerent in the war. The latest development is a commitment by the United States and Germany to send heavy battle tanks, Abrams and Leopard 2s, to Kiev, a step that hawks have been advocating for weeks. End of quote. I want to insert in here that over a year ago, I made the prediction that any tanks that made their way, Western provisioned tanks, that made their way to the eastern third of the Ukraine under Russian fire would be turned into scrap within a week. All of that has taken place. We continue. Quote, the United States also has approved the transfer of Patriot air defense missiles to Kyiv. Despite continued wariness, the Biden administration may even change its policy about supplying Ukraine with long-range artillery rockets capable of striking targets inside Russia. A dramatic escalation of U.S. and NATO involvement in the Ukraine war is taking place, and that move is yet another reckless provocation towards Russia. End of quote. I have discussed before where not only is this provocation so dangerous in escalating to a permanent conflict that will become very warlike now and in the future between first world nations, peer nations. Remember, I stopped using the word next peer because Yemen has proven that they are a peer to the United States Navy, for instance, in the Red Sea. Carpenter goes on, quote, the conventional wisdom among members of the transatlantic foreign policy blob is that such warnings are just posturing, that Russia would never dare take military action against a NATO member. It is not a comforting realization that many of the same individuals were equally certain that Moscow's repeated warnings since 2007, to include William Burns' 2008 cable to the State Department when he was the ambassador to Moscow, saying that Ukraine was a red line for NATO membership. The war in Ukraine is a definitive evidence that such assumptions were wrong. What if the conventional wisdom in the West that Russia will continue indefinitely to tolerate NATO's provision of even more powerful weapons to Moscow's enemy proves equally erroneous? Russia's national symbol is the bear, and a bear is one dangerous animal. A cornered bear is an especially dangerous animal. Western policymakers would be wise to remember that point before pushing the Russian government into a corner with respect to the Ukraine war. Belligerent status in a war is like pregnancy in one important sense. It is not possible to be half pregnant. Likewise, it is not possible for the United States or other NATO countries to be sort of non-belligerents in the Ukraine war. Washington and its allies have sought to maintain such an impossibly precarious status, but they are now careening toward becoming full-fledged belligerents, regardless of attempts to preserve the legal fiction to the contrary. One cannot overstate the danger of that strategy. Carpenter pens that in January of 2023. So it appears that this article is 2 years old, not the 1 year that I just said. Yet it is true, everything that he said, and we are in an even more dangerous position as we speak. Now I'd like to read from one of my favorite websites, antiwar.com, that I've been visiting on a daily basis since 1999. I would urge all of you, if you haven't, to visit that. That's as a conflict historian and a conflict futurist. I have found that probably to be the single most helpful site that I use to get my news about what's going on around the world. My old listeners know this. My new listeners probably do not. I always urge people not to listen to the news, not to consume the news. There's a reason that they call it programming, but to pay attention to editorials and opinion pieces, of which there are many to be had at antiwar.com that I follow, because when you do editorials and opinion pieces, it allows you not only to employ your own bias filter with full recognizance, but you know, because it happens to be an opinion piece, what their bias filter may be. And between the two of those, you can ascertain and apprehend the single most accurate picture. Do not consume the news, no matter where it comes from. Ted Snyder, U.S. foreign policy was never about promoting democracy, March 20th, 2025. U.S. President Donald Trump may or may not have been joking when he promised to be dictator for a day, or when he called himself the king, or when he asserted that he is above the law, or when he has teased about seeking a third term. But in his first weeks in the White House, a contest has emerged over whether Trump will defend democracy abroad or dismiss it. In two cases, he has tilted against democracy, and in one, he has championed it. The distinguishing feature seems to be not commitment to democracy, but commitment to leaders that align with Trump's vision. The U.S. spent the Biden administration turning a blind eye to the disintegration of democracy in Ukraine. Though Biden promoted the war in Ukraine as the great battle for freedom, a battle between democracy and autocracy, he simultaneously said that Ukraine isn't ready for NATO membership because Ukraine had qualifications that need to be met, including democratization. Ukraine's president, Zelensky, has signed legislation that banned opposition parties, limited freedom of the press and of free speech, and limited religious freedom and linguistic and cultural rights. But Trump has taken America from spectator to participant by interfering in Ukrainian politics. According to U.S. officials, Trump has made it clear to his team that he wants Zelensky to make some movement towards elections in Ukraine and possibly towards stepping down as his country's leader. And he is doing more than just talking to his team. Members of his team have held secret discussions with some of Kyiv's top political opponents to Zelensky. And it is not just because Trump feels that the elections in Ukraine are overdue. The talks have not been about holding quick presidential elections. And because Trump aides are confident that Zelensky would lose in a vote, those discussions focus on the possibility of removing Zelensky, end of quote. Now, what Snyder is apprehending here is what is referred to in the old school as realpolitik. Kissinger was a big champion of this during his decades being an advisor to probably 8 or 9 presidents during his entire long life here in America. Some of it good advice, most of it bad advice. Realpolitik means that you are trying to do something that is in the national self-interest. Now, there is a fellow by the name of Georgescu in Romania. He has just been arrested. Well, not just. November 2024, Calin Georgescu in Romania, described as Moscow friendly, European Union unfriendly, and as a NATO critic. To take from Steiner's article, in December, quote, in December, the Romanian courts annulled his victory, citing evidence-free and remarkably weak claims of Russian interference in support of his campaign, and canceled the second round runoff vote. Georgescu was then arrested, again on evidence-free or unclear charges for, quote, incitement to actions against the constitutional order, the communication of false information, and involvement in the establishment of an organization with a fascist, racist, or xenophobic character. On March 9th, Romania's Central Electoral Bureau rendered its decision to block Georgescu from participating in Romania's election, ironically on the grounds that he violated the very obligation to defend democracy. 2 days later, Georgescu lost his final approval as Romania's constitutional court unanimously ruled against him. End of quote. There was tremendous pressure from Brussels and the EU as they have levied against the allegedly right-wing parties in Germany like the AfD to not win elections because it does not conform to what Brussels wishes to do. Now, Georgescu may also align more neatly with Trump's worldview, and while the EU has done nothing to defend Romania's democracy, the Trump administration this time has. At the same Munich Security Conference that Vance seemingly interfered in Germany's democracy, he came to the defense of Romania, saying that Romania straight up canceled the results of a presidential election based on the flimsy suspicions of an intelligence agency and enormous pressure from its continental neighbors. He concludes, Biden was an ideological cold warrior who presented the facade of a foreign policy based on democracy versus autocracy. Trump is transactional pragmatist. He's a transactional pragmatist who has ripped away the facade and appears to interfere in democracy or defend it in pursuit of partners who advance not the American ideal of democracy, but American interest, end of quote. Now, I don't know if Snyder is tongue-in-cheek in here or not, but the recent demolition of the United States Agency for International Development, and then, of course, its concomitant tentacled enclaves in the National Endowment for Democracy, the Peace Institute, and all the rest of them, they have been using clandestine and covert and color revolution means planet-wide for the last probably three generations to significantly increase America's secret or not-so-secret involvement in shifting elections, shifting political outcomes and such. What Trump has done is he sort of ripped the Band-Aid off of that and taken it out of the shadows. And now, in practicing a realpolitik, he is, by extension, making sure that those things that are good for America's self-interest are advanced instead of those things that are good for the, quote, international rules-based order. In case you haven't noticed, we've all been living in the Truman Show when it comes to American foreign policy. And now all of a sudden, we're finding out otherwise. So what we have here is not only a dysfunctional realpolitik and international rules-based order that constantly seems to plug and champion war at every turn that it can, but also we've discovered that intelligence agencies across the West have been using this as a means to create, out of whole cloth, causes belli for creating wars in the first place. After the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, happening after the 9/11 events on the U.S. homeland, 2 years later, the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, his son, invades Iraq and has 21 causes belli, of which none of those 21 are aligned with reality whatsoever on reflection to get America involved in Iraq, which ends ignominiously between 2015 and 2016, the eventual reduction. And of course, we can fast forward to what happened a mere few years ago in Afghanistan with the ignominious but late and long expected withdrawal from Afghanistan, which should have happened in 2002 and not when it did. Now, I would urge everybody within earshot of this podcast, if you draw anything from this one episode, I want you to get a book by Edward Bernays called Propaganda. Rather inexpensive, I think it's like 112 pages, but he is the father of modern propaganda. Born in 1891, he published this book in 1928, and he argued that public relations is not a gimmick, but a necessity. I quote, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, and our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. It is they who pull the wires that control the public mind," end of quote. Now, even though Bernays saw the power of propaganda during war and used it to sell products during peacetime, he couldn't have imagined that his writings on public relations would become a tool of the Third Reich, and they did. In the 1920s, Joseph Goebbels became an avid admirer of Bernays and his writings, despite the fact that Bernays was a Jew. When Goebbels became the Minister of Propaganda for the Third Reich, he sought to exploit Bernays' ideas to the fullest extent possible. For example, he created a Führer cult around Adolf Hitler. Bernays learned that the Nazis were using his work in 1933 from a foreign correspondent for Hearst newspapers. He later recounted in his 1965 autobiography, quote, "They were using my books as a basis for a destructive campaign against the Jews of Germany. This shocked me. But I knew any human activity can be used for social purposes or misused for antisocial ones," end of quote. I highly recommend that you consider anything that you hear from the megaphones in the public space, whether they come from the government, corporations, or institutions of education, whatever the case may be, know that this kind of conscious and unconscious manipulation of your perception and apprehension of the world takes place in a very deliberate fashion. And I would urge you, in light of what this podcast episode is about, is that what you're seeing with the EU, SSR, and NATO is that they are absolutely pounding the pavement and rustling up the drumbeat for war for no good reason. But then again, most wars happen for no good reason. If you take anything away from this episode, please, by the gods, get that book by Bernays, 112 pages, like I said. Read it. Maybe you can find a shorter version of it that that you can use to apprehend what it's all about. And you will know how you are being played on a consistent basis, both publicly, government, privately, corporations, maybe even friends, family, colleagues, are unconsciously employing white or black propaganda means to insinuate in your mind, mind viruses and mind worms that have you marching to the drumbeat of war in this case. Now, I had mentioned at the beginning of this episode, Finland and Sweden have gotten rid of their former neutrality, and that here we find them also beating the drumbeat for war. Now, I wanted to examine Finland as exhibit A of why all of this on the part of the EU, SSR, and NATO is so ill-founded, and none of this will end well for Europe, and none of it will end well for the US if it participates in these extraordinarily irrational and jingoistic policies that we're presently seeing emanating from the continent. We are going to examine Finland, by the way, for about 100 years, Sweden was a superpower back in the day until the 18th century. Finland was never a superpower. Finland has always been a tiny country. When I say tiny country, I don't mean the size of the landscape. I mean the population. Presently, Finland has 5.5 million people in residence on their soil. And they just so happen to have a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia, the largest border with Russia now, with their entry into NATO, of any NATO country. Now, I'm not going to bore you, because of the brevity of the podcast episode, with a lot of the specifics of what the Finns have been up to in the past century and what their martial prowess is. Some of you may have seen a film that I enjoyed immensely called Sisu, about a Finn fighting the Germans apparently on their way out of the country of Finland in 1944 and 45, where they laid waste to significant parts of the Finnish countryside on their return journey and retreat to escape the Russian advance that was progressing rather well by that time in 1944 and 1945. What you had was you had several components of this conflict. I will leave several book recommendations about the various Finnish conflicts that took place during this time, starting in 1939 to 1940, where the Soviet Union at the time, which was allied with Germany in a non-aggression pact, invaded Finland, and the Finns acquitted themselves by every measure extraordinarily well. Then, by the time that particular conflict ends in March 1940, a temporary peace is had after frantic diplomatic efforts between the USSR and the Finns. The Finns then ally themselves, not formally, but ally themselves nonetheless with the Germans, and then even participating in the Battle of Stalingrad as Axis troops. During the war in March 1944, FDR, the President of the United States, called for Finland to disassociate itself from Nazi Germany. Then in June 1944, the Red Army launched a major strategic offensive against Finland. And now, as you recall, this is probably almost 4.5 years after the previous conflict that they had with the USSR. And this did not go well for them at all. And what you find is by war's end in May 1945, that the Finns are in a rather precarious stalemate with the USSR, and found themselves through a Russian armistice the Moscow Armistice, which was signed by Finland and the USSR on September 19, 1944. It ended the continuation war, which had brewed up after FDR had urged them not to be aligned with Nazi Germany, but that would not be signed until 1947 in Paris. This resulted in the Lapland War that was fought between Finland and Nazi Germany in Lapland, the northernmost part of Finland. The main strategic interest of Germany in the region was the nickel mines in the Petsamo area. And I suspect that when one watches the film Sisu, which I urge you to do, I get the intimation that that's where that was occurring. Initially, the warfare was cautious on both sides, reflecting the previous cooperation of the two countries against our common enemy, but by the end of 1944, the fighting intensified. Finland and Germany had made an informal agreement and schedule for German troops to withdraw from Lapland to Norway. The Soviet Union did not accept this friendliness and pressured Finland to take a more active role in pushing the Germans out of Lapland, thus intensifying hostilities. And henceforth, the Germans adopted a scorched earth policy, and they laid waste to the entire northern half of the country as they retreated. Around 100,000 people lost their homes, adding to the burden of post-war reconstruction. Now, actual loss of life was actually pretty light. I think the Finns lost maybe 1,000 troops, Germany maybe 2,000, and then the Finnish army expelled the last of the foreign troops from Finland in April 1945. You saw something very interesting occurring during the Cold War. This is from 1946 to 1991. Finland was attempting to stake a middle ground between the Western and Eastern blocs. And if you take a look at a map, you'll see why that's so important to them. As I mentioned, yes, they have that in excess of 1,300 kilometer border with Russia proper, largest between Europe and Russia. Also, 5.5 million folks living in this very, very large country. During the period 88 to 91, when the Baltic states were pursuing independence from the Soviet Union, Finland finally avoided supporting the Baltic independence movement publicly, but did support it in the form of practical cooperation. However, after the failed 1991 August coup in Russia, Finland recognized the Baltic states and restored diplomatic relations. And of course, this fast-paced them from 1992 to the present to sort of disassociate themselves from the Russian-Finnish rapprochement and stalemate that they had between each other. And now we can fast forward to today, where in December 2021, the Russian Ministry for Foreign Affairs pressured Finland and Sweden to refrain from joining NATO. However, a mere year later, Finland's President Sauli Niinisto, please forgive me, those who speak Finnish, reasserted Finnish sovereignty by stating that the Finnish government reserved the right to apply for NATO membership. Furthermore, Niinisto said that Russian demands threaten the European security order, end of quote. So what that does is it brings us to where we're at now today with this. And I think that while Ukraine and its potential NATO membership is a casus belli for the Russians to behave in the fashion that they are, starting over 3 years ago when they started the special military operation into the Ukraine, I happen to think that it is very important and providential for future historians to look back on Finland's acceptance into NATO, most likely as the sine qua non that really lights the fuse of future bad blood, well, present and future bad blood, between Russia, NATO, and the EU-SSR. I am at W. Bubert on Twitter. If you get the opportunity to follow me, I would urge you to do so. I follow several very keen, savvy, and smart conflict observers at Twitter. One of them goes by the moniker of Armchair Warlord, at Armchair W. I urge you, if you get the opportunity, to watch what he does and listen to what he has to say. So I'd like to quote, he says here in this one post, 22 March, quote, how to get conquered by Russia, let's actually evaluate the force Finland can deploy in wartime. According to official Finnish arms control disclosures, as of 2023, the Finnish Army maintains 7 brigades all in reserve. Let's evaluate their stockpile in that light. According to the same document, the Finnish Army has 200 modern main battle tanks and 1,100 APCs and IFVs. Those would be armored personnel carriers and infantry fighting vehicles, including 320 old MTLBs and 110 BIMP-2s. Those would be old Soviet-era rolling stock. On a NATO table of organization equipment with 44 vehicles per battalion, that's enough to equip 4 armored battalions and 25 infantry battalions for a total of 29 battalions. Assuming a U.S. Army BCT-type organization, that would be Brigade Combat Team, with 4 maneuver battalions per brigade, the Finns have enough combat vehicles to equip those 7 brigades plus 1 infantry battalion and general reserve. Given the actual structure of the Finnish Army, this likely shakes out to 1 armor brigade with 3 tank battalions and 1 mechanized infantry brigade with a tank battalion and 5 motorized infantry brigades with no tanks at all. One of those would be a cavalry squadron in the U.S. Army. Now, going on to Finnish Army artillery is a somewhat more complicated subject, but it appears that they have approximately 220 150-millimeter howitzers between towed and self-propelled units. By the way, those 155s, that would be Western, not Russian era, of which half are L-39s and half are modern L-52s. This is enough to equip 12 artillery battalions, plus an additional 4 rocket and missile battalions. This is a reasonable artillery park to support a core force and above. Core, in this case, would be the amalgamation umbrella organization under which those brigades would operate. The Finns also possess a large number of Soviet 122-millimeter pieces and a handful of 152-millimeter guns, of which an unknown number have been given to Ukraine. The remainders of this stockpile would be the only heavy weaponry available to equip any additional units raised from mobilized reservists. Assuming those donations have been modest, the Finns could equip perhaps 20 additional reserve infantry brigades at a Second World War level with truck transport and a single artillery battalion each. Now, this appears to be the source of the claim that the Finns could mobilize a fairly large army in wartime by relying on their pool of trained reservists. It's worth noting, however, that this is not going to be a good army. It's going to be a force that relies on a defensive front of poorly equipped, poorly supported, middle-aged conscripts dying in enormous numbers under Russian artillery to protect a much smaller elite mobile reserve that is itself only optimistically comparable to any given Russian unit of equivalent size. Now, think the late war AFU with far less ammunition, dodgy supply lines back to NATO, a pre-war drone force, and little ability to reconstitute material losses, which will pile up enormously quickly. End of quote. I want to insert some observations here. Now, when he talks about the artillery pieces that they have, do they have the requisite amount of artillery munitions to maintain the kind of salvos that the Russians are accustomed to? Who knows? We also know, it, for those of you who have listened to me before, and those of you who have not, is that the era of the manned tank, the manned armored personnel vehicle, the manned infantry fighting vehicle are over. Drones have made it so that all of those vehicles, along with all flesh on the battlefield in the next 5 years, are forfeit and will become scrap over time. He continues, quote, now add in the fact that Finland, while heavily propagandized against Russia, is a wealthy democracy and not a totalitarian hellhole like Ukraine. The Finnish government has sold its public on the idea that Finnish forces are qualitatively far superior to the Russians and cannot throw bodies at the problem once it turns out otherwise, at least not without a public outcry. In short, this is a force that is going to get manhandled if it comes to war and as a secondary line of effort for the Russian military, end of quote. I want to tell you that qualitatively and quantitatively, the Finns don't have any ass to make this war count for themselves and to acquit themselves. Starting from D plus 1, which would be a possible, and I don't say probable, I say possible, Russian provocation, they would lose everything within 72 hours that is a vehicle. And within 10 days, their personnel would be exhausted through catastrophic loss, mission-capable loss, and the ability to field any organization beyond the strength of a battalion. Now, armchair warlord, and I like to exemplify this myself, he brings the hand receipts and the footnotes to tell you where he got that information. I will place that information in the show notes so you can take a look for yourself. It is a document that is approximately 13 pages long called Confidence and Security Building Measures. It says Vienna Document 2011, but it is valid as of 2023, and it has a very detailed coding of the strength and what they have on the ground in the Finnish Army. Now, many have said, and I have even looked at it myself, that the Finnish Armed Forces are approximately 50,000 in strength, 18,000 active duty. But I have heard folks say, well, we're Finns, and we can deploy up to 800,000 troops out of a population of 5.5 million. I rather doubt this. So here is a rough measure that you can employ that I have employed in my conflict and asymmetric war and conventional war studies. When it comes to manning in a conflict, especially left of bang, and what that's going to look like to come up with a proper estimate for manning. So here's what I use as a rule. Now, mind you, this is a bell curve, and there could be left and right wing exceptions to this in the single digits that would be far larger than the percentages that I'm going to prognosticate on. But here's the rule of thumb that one uses as a metric for total number of fighting forces and a lesser number of trigger pullers in said fighting forces because of tooth-to-tail ratios or tail-to-tooth, which would be 10 to 1, which means that for every trigger puller, you're going to need probably, by Western Army standards, about 10 combat service and combat service support entities behind them so that that trigger puller can conduct the fire and maneuver that he would in order to achieve the mission that is given to them to the corps level and below, down to brigades, battalions, companies, platoons, all the way down to squads and fire teams. So here's the magic metric. You take every male between the age of 18 and 35 that happens to be in that country left of bang prior to the war, you take 25% of that, and that gives you the maximum number of trigger pullers and their associated logistics tail that you could find in said country. So if we apply that metric to Finland, here's the number we come up with. According to Finnish statistics, they use the age group 20 to 39, which of course includes that 18 to 35 age group. They say that's approximately 1.4 million people. The men versus women, they call it half and half. So we're going to call that 700,000 people. And what we're going to do with that 700,000 number is we are going to say, and mind you, I think that this is optimistic because I would rather go with 20 than 25, but I'm trying to increase the number of men that they would probably talk about. That number would be 175,000 eligible young men, possibly, not probably, possibly eligible to be trigger pullers and combat service support, and logistics personnel to support the push. Now, if we take that 10 to 1 tail to tooth ratio with 175,000, what that means is essentially 17,000 to 22,000 total trigger pullers. But none of this squares with what they presently have in their active duty forces, which number below 20,000. They advertise 24,000. I think 20,000 is a more accurate number. And they have a wartime strength projected at 280,000 troops, including conscripts, and a large reserve force. And apparently they have a small but capable Air Force and Navy. I guarantee you, in the improbable fight with the Russians, everything that they would have that is rolling stock or airborne or on the ocean would be gone by D plus 10 in a conflict between the two of them. And by the way, I'm not saying in any sense whatsoever, am I trying to diminish the bravery, capability, and advanced weapons skills of the Finnish army? They are simply outclassed and outmanned in every respect. But I also don't think, when I'm considering this, that the Russians have the capability to take on Europe, or that they have the capability to both have conflict in the theater in the Ukraine, in which the majority of their forces are, or to force a lodgment and expand that lodgment into Finland proper, or one of the tinier Balkan states, one of which has a European land bridge between itself and the Russian territory of Kaliningrad. I don't see any of this happening, but what I do see is that I, for one, don't think that the Russians want to invade a square millimeter or meter of European land, because they know ultimately that would lead to an escalation of hostilities that could even entertain the exchange of nuclear weapons, which none of us want. But here we have a country, and a country of countries, in other words, the EUSSR, the EU in this case, is where the respective governments, I think 31, 32, 33, that are presently aligning themselves under the Brussels regime, have said one government isn't enough. We're going to take on another government to observe all of our governments as an umbrella to further immiserate and make us economically poorer than we were before, including what happens with the NATO. EU comes with taxes and tariffs and obligations and laws and rules and regulations that its constituent countries need to abide by or else. The same thing applies to NATO, all of that in order to fund it. And now we have the Brussels elites talking about forming a European force, forming a military force that would be united, maybe even post-NATO, where the Europeans would have an EU army of sorts. They're talking about raising $800 billion to $1 trillion, which matches the military budget of the United States, to fund said European force. Now, I've talked about NATO not only in that one episode 2 months ago where I asked for the United States to consider and suggested that the administration leave NATO for a lot of reasons, to include the fact that the sooner we get out of there, the better, because then we don't have Americans as tripwires that leads to a greater war, that leads to the third European war in a little under 120 years, something that we should not participate in under any circumstances when peace is an option, and peace is an option across the board for all of this. But under NATO, when it came to interoperability, which is the ability of all of those forces to integrate themselves in a sound fashion so that they would have a unified and unitary mechanism to fight, in the case of the USSR and the Warsaw Pact after World War II, through 1989 to 1991, have the ability to fight cohesively. That never occurred prior to the fall of the wall. It certainly started to disintegrate in a bad way after the fall of the wall. It is my estimation that the Europeans, especially when you look at the disasters that have pretty much been cognizant with the disasters that the U.S. has had in acquisition since the 1980s, those same things plague them when it comes to the delivery of proper armaments. There have been successful ships, for instance, like the corvettes and frigate minuses that the Scandinavian countries develop are, I would call them first-tier naval vessels now. These are smaller naval vessels. There are only two countries in the EU and NATO that are foolish enough to have carriers. That would be Britain with two and France with one, the Charles de Gaulle. There is a future carrier that's being planned that will be commissioned in 2038. Yeah, right. We'll see what happens with that. Let's keep in mind that that one active nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that the French have is, in fact, nuclear-powered, and that the two carriers that the Royal Navy has are not there conventionally powered. One can imagine the flotilla of logistics that is necessary for that. But then again, the flotilla of logistics and protection that is required for all aircraft carriers is enormous. As a matter of fact, as those of you who have listened to me in the past know that I consider the aircraft carrier the chariot and the crossbow of the 21st century. These are 20th century modalities. And for the most part, and I hope that America doesn't learn this in a grisly and morbid fashion, they are future fish apartments. So that being the case, when I, as an amateur conflict observer and futurist, look at the ambitions and plans of the EU independent of the United States, let's suppose that the Trump regime takes on the sobering perspective and says, yeah, no more of NATO because we don't want to be involved in any more European wars and the Europeans are on their own, I do think that it will be a chaos avalanche and a cavalcade of calamities when it comes to crafting their aircraft inventory, their armies, coordinating them, having the interoperability between all these countries, being able to breach all the language barriers. And not only that, being able to take on, if they have the misfortune of doing so, and they are the ones who are rattling the sabers to do so, not the Russians. The Russians are, again, the most blooded, the most experienced, and in many ways, the most advanced land army on the face of the planet as we speak. So I would conclude by saying this. I had said in episode 9, America needs to leave NATO. 2 months later, I feel even more strongly America needs to leave NATO. I am perplexed, appalled, and just absolutely mystified by the European desire to not seek peace in Ukraine, but trying to escalate that conflict. And I would leave you with this. The new administration, the changes that are taking place in the United States, the audit investigations, and the absolute inability of the West, the U.S., and of course, U.K. is patient zero for this, absolute lack of interest in peace talks since the start of the special military operation with the invasion by Russia of Ukraine because of that red line that had been identified as early as 2008 by William Burns, now the head of the CIA, then the Russian ambassador, saying again and again that all of these provocations took place as a result of Western perfidy and mischief-making and color revolutions to include what happened in the Ukraine in 2014. If you want to see the hand receipts, the footnotes, the evidence, and all of this on why this happened in the first place, look no further than Provoked by Scott Horton, available at the Libertarian Institute. Yes, I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, but I happen to not only have a copy for myself, which is well-thumbed and has all kinds of tabs in it, also gave them to my sons. They love it. If you want to know what happened here as far as the Ukraine or Russia, that is the book to go to. And in the greater sense, if you want to know why we need to leave NATO soonest, that is also the book to go to. So thanks for listening. I look forward to your feedback, your comments, your recommendations. You can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That's cgpodcast@pm.me. You can reach me at the Chasing Ghost podcast Substack, where I have a comments function, and I love interacting and listening and hearing the conversations that we can have about my various podcast episodes. This is so incredibly important, this whole issue. So I thank you for listening. I thank you for your solicitude, and I would urge you to recommend that friends, family, colleagues listen to this. If you find it useful and interesting, and I am forever obliged if you will leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast vendor. This is Bill out.